Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
On the road, in the air, on the water, all to track down Willie Nelson. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, one man's mission to play a single song for the redheaded stranger. Plus, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony like you've never heard it before. And a live performance from the Norwegian singer-songwriter Sondre Lerche. But we begin our show today with a tale of skullduggery, trickery, and chicanery. According to my first guest, it's all part of a day in the life of so-called song pluggers, people whose job it is to pitch songs to artists. One of those people is Randy Poe. He's president of Lieber & Stoller Music Publishing, and he's also the author of a new book called Stalking the Red-Headed Stranger, which chronicles his 8,000-mile journey to track down Willie Nelson just to play him one song. Randy Poe joins me on the line from L.A. Randy, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much, John.
Song plugging's been around for over 100 years. Your tale happens in 2006. You're no longer, you know, the pianist in the store window. Why not just email the guy?
Oh, I wish I'd thought of that.
Is it that simple? You just didn't think of it?
No, it was Jerry Lieber said to me, I was at his house, and he said, I want you to pitch the Sinatra song, which is the one song that Frank Sinatra recorded, written by Lieber and Stoller. Mm-hmm. He said, I want you to pitch the Sinatra song to your buddy Willie. And I had no idea what he meant. But it turns out he thought, because of some photos on the wall in my office, that Willie and I were pals. And so he said, you know the guy, play the song for him. I want you to do it face-to-face, in person, and go. And I didn't stop to think to say, well, first of all, I don't know Willie Nelson. Or secondly, why don't I just email it to him? I said, okay, I will go on this mission. And I did.
And this mission, first of all, involved you finding... Yeah, I mean, this is like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego when you're trying to track down Willie Nelson? It must have been a heck of a song for Jerry Lieber, part of one of the most successful songwriting partnerships in American pop music history, to have sent you on this mission. What song was it in particular?
The song in question is called The Girls I Never Kissed. It was a song that Mike and Jerry wrote among their more adult material. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say that without it sounding like porn.
Yeah. No, but you know, they're known for having written a lot of Elvis Presley's stuff and a lot of pop stuff. So this is more of a ballad.
This is a mature ballad. This is the guys who wrote "Is That All There Is" writing, as opposed to the guys who wrote "Hound Dog." This is a serious, beautiful ballad about a man looking back on his life, thinking about the ones he let get away.
All right. Well, it's not the song that launched 1,000 ships, but it certainly launched Randy Poe on his epic journey. It's the Frank Sinatra version of The Girls I Never Kissed.
The old wolf sniffs the summer breeze and dreams about his youth. For the sight of skirts above the knees turns his hard-boiled brain to cheese and the scent of honey in the trees whets an old sweet tooth. The pretty girls go strolling by, I look at them and heave a sigh and think of all the things I've missed and all the pretty girls I've never kissed.
The Girls I Never Kissed, 1986 recording by Frank Sinatra, song written by Lieber and Stoller. And Jerry Lieber sent my guest, Randy Poe, the president of Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing, out on the road to play this song for Willie Nelson. Now, that sounds like a fairly straightforward task. 8,000 miles later, we have Randy's book. Give me a moment, folks. I'm going to give you the full title of Randy's book, Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, or How to Get Your Songs into the Hands of the Artists Who Really Matter Through Show Business Trickery, Underhanded Skullduggery, Shrewdness and Chicanery, as well as various less nefarious methods of song plugging, a practical handbook and historical portrait. You almost didn't need to write a book after that title.
Yeah, it took me longer to write the title.
So why did Jerry, and did you agree with him, why did Jerry think that this song was a good fit for Willie Nelson?
Because Willie, over the years, has done a number of albums of classic standard ballads.
Right.
The Stardust album, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He did another one called What a Wonderful World, which is, in fact, a song that we published. He did a number of great standards recordings, and this seemed to fall into that same category.
All right. Now, did Willie Nelson know that you were hot on his trail, were looking for him?
No, he had no clue.
And nobody ever actually got in touch with him and said, hey, the president of Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing is trying to reach you? I mean,
no, it didn't happen that way. As I talk about in the book, I tried the manager first, as one would do, and he didn't call me back. I tried his PR person, who's a wonderful lady, and she wrote me a very nice note saying, love to help you, but it's got to go through the manager. And I realized I was kind of running out of possibilities. I didn't want to go back to Jerry and confess that I didn't know Willie and Willie didn't know me. So I had to go forward, and I remembered a friend of mine named John McEwen, of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah.
And I had a lunch with him 6-7 years earlier. And I remembered him telling me a funny story about he and Willie Nelson to the point that I thought, okay, he actually knows the guy. And so then it became a quest to find John McEwen to see if John could hook me up with Willie Nelson. Well, I had gone to the internet and found Willie's tour schedule,
mm-hmm.
and Willie was playing in Canada, and he was going from west to east, heading towards Newfoundland. And so I thought, well, where's McEwen? So I go on the internet, and I look up the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's tour schedule, and they, too, are going across Canada from west to east.
Yeah, well, problem solved then.
So I went back and forth between Willie's website and their website and discovered they were actually opening for Willie Nelson.
Uh-huh.
So it became a truth is stranger than fiction kind of scenario.
And how long did it take you to actually chase this guy down and finally get a little bit of FaceTime with him?
Well, it was pretty quick in the overall scheme of things. I started trying to book the trip over a weekend, and by the following weekend, I was on my way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from, forgive me, I can't remember the names of all the Canadian towns, but it was there were 4 flights to get me from Los Angeles to Nova Scotia. And then from Nova Scotia, we took ferry boat over to Newfoundland, and then it was in the second day in Newfoundland, which was going to be the last day that I could possibly pull this off, that we were able to hop on Willie's bus and play the song for him.
Now, Willie Nelson's bus is itself a kind of epic tale, and what happens on the Willie Nelson tour bus, in your case at least, did not stay on the Willie Nelson tour bus. How many laws were broken in the amount of time that you spent with Willie Nelson on the bus?
At least 2.
I mean, one of the ways, you know, people know where Willie Nelson is where's he being arrested now, you know? I mean, it seems like every time he goes to Texas, they drag him into court on some marijuana charge or something. So you found him there. He's in eastern Canada. what does he finally say when you get to finally play that Frank Sinatra song to him?
First of all, he listened to it really intently. I remember very distinctly that his daughter Lana was trying to serve him his breakfast, and he just kind of waved her away because he was listening to this song. And his reaction was, when the last note faded away, he was quiet for a minute, and then he said, you know, Frank Sinatra has always been my favorite singer. Mm-hmm. And he said, in a couple of interviews, he said I was his favorite singer. And he said, I've always been really proud of that.
Wow.
And I said, as well you should. So that was his reaction, was a non-reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you know, I took as, didn't say he loves it, didn't say he hates it, he listened to it. Mission accomplished.
Because that is literally what Jerry Lieber had set you to do, was just play the song for him. What did playing the song for him entail? I mean, do you travel with an iPod or a cassette deck? How does this happen?
In 2006, I had it on an iPod, and that, in fact, was part of how I actually got it to him. On this ferry boat, which was part of the adventure, I was sitting with his musical director and harmonica player, Mickey Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
And Mickey said, so what's this song sound like? And I said, I've got it here on my iPod. And so he listened to it. And he said, man, I dig the changes, meaning the chord changes. And he said, Willie's got to hear this. And later on this never-ending ferry boat ride of about 7 hours, Willie went walking past, and Mickey said, hey, Willie, Randy's got the Sinatra song he needs you to hear. And that's what really set it off.
Uh-huh.
It was all, you know, to use an L.A. word, it was all a pretty organic experience. It just kind of unveiled itself as the trip progressed. And luckily, I had had the iPod so that Mickey could hear it, and then on Willie's bus, it was just a plain old CD because he has a CD player on his bus.
We're speaking with Randy Poe. He's author of the book Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, which recounts his 8,000-mile journey to track down Willie Nelson, catching up with him in Canada, to play him this song that Lieber and Stoller wrote called The Girls I Never Kissed. So you play it for him, you get this sort of intense non-reaction from him. So he hasn't recorded the song, at least not yet. Have you given up hope, or is there a chance something might still happen?
First of all, the book is about the opposite of giving up hope. I mean, the book is really kind of a how to make it and despite all odds.
Right.
I think folks might get a kick out of learning a bit about my history and how I worked my way into the music business in the first place, because I did do it via all those words on the cover.
So were you? Did you start as a musician, or did you just start as a kind of a song plugger?
I started as a disc jockey in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got on a Greyhound bus one day and moved to New York with $275 in my pocket, and sort of took it from there.
Mm-hmm.
I was always planning on being in the music business, and nobody was going to tell me that I wasn't going to be. I would go to the Lincoln Center Library. My days were spent passing out flyers, and at lunchtime, I would go to the Lincoln Center Library because I was passing out flyers in front of Lincoln Center. I would take that week's Billboard magazine, memorize every face, every person, what their title was, what label they worked for, who they represented, etc., until I knew the names and faces of everybody that mattered in the music business at that time. And then I would crash parties and meet them.
Mm-hmm. And is that how you met Lieber and Stoller?
Indirectly, yes. I managed to stumble my way up to becoming the executive director of the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
and Bill Boggs. Remember Bill Boggs?
I do not.
Bill Boggs is a TV show host there in New York, and Bill was doing he wanted to interview a bunch of songwriters, and I suggested Sammy Kahn, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, George David Weiss. And I managed to get all of them to agree to be on Bill's noontime TV show.
Hmm.
And after the end of that show, an hour later, I noticed Mike and Jerry were just sitting at table talking to each other. And these guys had been my childhood heroes. These were the guys that wrote Charlie Brown for the Coasters. These were the guys who wrote Hound Dog for Elvis Presley. These were the guys who wrote songs that the Beatles recorded, like Some Other Guy. And so I said to myself, here you go. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. So I just went over, sat down between them, and started talking. And a couple of years later, I was working for them full time.
And then finally sent on this this epic journey to track down Willie Nelson and play one of their songs for him. As recounted in the book called Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, we're speaking with Randy Poe, and when Randy says, you know, how important Lieber and Stoller were to him as a kid, here's an example of why Lieber and Stoller were important to so many people.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time.
Lieber and Stoller wrote all of those hits. Hound Dog for Elvis, Love Potion Number 9 for the Clovers, There Goes My Baby for the Drifters, Jailhouse Rock, of course, Elvis again. And with me on the line from L.A., Randy Poe. He is author of the book Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, and he is now president of the Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing Group. And Lieber and Stoller, Randy, would they have needed song pluggers with songs like this, or did they have another way of getting this stuff out?
They never really needed song pluggers. They were brilliant from the beginning of their careers. They set up their own record label here in L.A. in the early 50s. And so they were going into the they were writing songs, going into the studio, recording those songs with artists that they had discovered, putting those recordings out on their own label. And so the whole process was internal. And then they were discovered. One of those recordings was heard by Nesawi Erdogan, Ahmet Erdogan's brother, and he
said, Atlantic Records.
From Atlantic Records, and he said, "We got to have these guys at Atlantic." And so Ahmet and Nesawi and Wexler, Jerry Wexler, were trying to convince Mike and Jerry to go to work for Atlantic Records, and they said, "We're not really interested in working for somebody else at this point. So what we'll do is we'll write and we'll produce recordings for you, and you'll just pay us by the record," thus creating the concept of the independent record producer. Prior to that moment in time, if you were a record producer, you were an employee of the label.
Right.
Mike and Jerry created this whole new concept whereby you would pay the producers a percentage on records sold. And
well,
now all producers are independent record producers.
It is worth mentioning, and in fact you mention it on page one of your introduction of the new book, that Jerry Lieber passed away actually not long after you finished writing the book. But of course, the music lives on. The Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing, the president of Lieber and Stoller Music Publishing, is my guest, Randy Poe. He's also author of the new book, Stalking the Redheaded Stranger, one of those Truth is Stranger Than Fiction tales. And Randy, thanks for sharing it with us on Soundcheck today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Here's a song that Randy was able to get Willie Nelson to record. The Lieber and Stoller blues classic, Kansas City.
They got some mighty pretty women there, and I'm gonna get me one. I'm gonna be standing on the corner.
Up next, one of Beethoven's best-loved works gets remixed Brooklyn style. And later, live music from the Norwegian-born, New York-based musician Sondre Lerche. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Eroica Symphony was a watershed moment in Beethoven's career and in the development of the classical symphony. You don't mess with the Eroica Symphony. Here, messing with the Eroica Symphony, is Alan Pearson, the Brooklyn Philharmonic's artistic director, joining me in the studio to talk a bit about the Beethoven Remix Project. Alan, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John. That's maybe the best introduction I've ever gotten.
So, I mean, it is. The Eroica Symphony was a watershed, a real landmark in Beethoven and the development of the symphony. Why remix that piece?
Well, and to make it even a little more sacred, it's also a watershed in the development of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. It was the piece we played on the very first Brooklyn Philharmonia Society concert in 1857. And then when the sort of current or most current era of the Philharmonic started in the 1950s, it was again played on the first concert. So it has this history, not only obviously in the classical music world at large, but specifically with the Brooklyn Philharmonic.
Well, that would suggest that maybe it's time to play Beethoven's Eroica Symphony again. But instead, you're inviting people to do remixes of it. How does that play into the program?
Right. Well, really, like, the remix project is part of a larger story we're telling throughout the year, which has to do with what the Brooklyn Philharmonic is doing now, which mm-hmm. is, you know, we're no longer an institution as we were in those past, you know, the 1950s and the 1850s debuts of, you know, that generation of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. We're now a mobile organization that's going out into all these different communities around Brooklyn and doing things, creating events, making collaborations happen in these communities in ways which speak to what's already there. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing movements of the Beethoven on each of our concerts this year, each one in a different community, and each one presented in a way that speaks to what that community is all about. And so when we were planning our Bed-Stuy concert, the remix just seemed the natural way to go. I mean, remixing being such a tradition in that community.
So what are the rules for the Beethoven Remix Project?
Right, that's an interesting question. We brought in a guy named Sam Hilmer, who had worked with the Beacon Center and had nurtured a bunch of local artists. And we brought him in to help us run this project. Mm-hmm. And he worked with us to organize this process. And we took in applicants. And then once we had selected our finalists, we brought them all together in a room with Sam and with members of the Brooklyn Philharmonic to talk about what the process was going to be. We didn't lay down any specific rules. I mean, the guidelines were that we wanted them to draw as much as they could from the Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And I guess we talked more about ideas than we did about rules. And it was very much an open conversation.
But it's the final movement
of the Eroica Symphony
that they were charged with remixing.
Right, that's right. So when they were all given a recording of mm-hmm. the final movement, and then also we gave them individual tracks, which were unfortunately MIDI. We would have loved to have been able to give them, you know, separate recordings of the flute, oboe, clarinet parts.
Right.
They had that material, and we wanted them to do as much with it as they could. We were looking for them to do something that was really their own with it, but that would still have a sense of connection to the original, so that someone who knew the symphony could hear how ideas were taken from it and then put in, ideally, a completely new context. You know, we wanted people to feel the connection to the original, but to blow their minds at the same time.
So first you picked the five finalists, and they're the ones invited to do the remixes.
Right.
And one of these five will actually be orchestrated. So you're taking an orchestral piece, giving it to remixers, and then you're taking the remix and putting it back in the acoustic realm for the orchestra.
Exactly.
In time for this June 9th concert in Bed-Stuy. It's the Brooklyn Philharmonic's Beethoven Remix Project. Alan Pearson is the Brooklyn Phil's artistic director, and this remix comes from the Brooklyn-based DJ and producer Eddie Mars. DJ Eddie Mars and his remix of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the fourth movement. I like it.
Yeah, this is a great remix. And, you know, one thing I think that's probably different about what DJ Eddie Mars did with this and most of the others is that he really stuck with the recording.
Yeah, you can hear, I mean, there are clear, you know, passages of
right.
the original
right.
there.
Right.
What about, for something a little different, who is Andrew McLean?
Right. Andrew McLean was born in Jamaica. I think he's probably the only, if not one of the only finalists who actually has a degree, who actually studied composition at university. He was at Bournemouth University, I believe.
In the UK.
In the UK, and mm-hmm. you know, studied composition there.
So born in Jamaica, educated in the UK, and now living in Brooklyn.
Yeah, right, right. And there's his compared to Eddie Mars, he used more of the electronic tracks, more of the MIDI stuff. And there's a really nice use in his of the Poco Andante from towards the end of the fourth movement, which is just gorgeous.
So he remixes under the name Complex.
Right.
And this is his Beethoven remix. From the producer known as Complex, real name Andrew McLean. That's his Beethoven remix, part of the Brooklyn Phil's Beethoven Remix Project. Alan Pearson, the artistic director of the orchestra, with me on soundcheck. And the Brooklyn Phil will perform one of the five Beethoven remixes in an orchestral arrangement at their Bed-Stuy concert on June 9th. You can find a link to hear all five of the finalist remixes on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. So again, the ultimate prize here is a world premiere performance of an orchestral piece by a producer, by a remixer.
Right, right.
How is that going to happen? How would you turn something like what we've just heard into oboes and violins and cellos and timpani and stuff?
Right. Well, the guy we brought in to do that is another Bed-Stuy artist whose name is Andrew Norman, who's a brilliant young composer and is a brilliant orchestrator. And part of why we brought him in for this and why I picked him to do this part of the project is that he's got a great orchestrational mind. And I thought, here's a guy who could take these, you know, very much, in many ways, not orchestral sounds and figure out how to really creatively bring them to life with the orchestra.
Well, and you, Alan, with your other band, Alarm Will Sound, have done this sort of thing quite successfully in the past with the music of Aphex Twin and your Acoustica project of
right.
electronica played acoustically.
Right.
Well, June 9th, when do we know who the winner of the five will be?
I think it'll be in about another month.
Okay. In the meantime, one of the other finalists, and again, they're all on our webpage, is this submission from a group of Brooklyn Community Arts and Media high school students calling themselves the Swagbarians. The Swagbrarians.
Yes.
And their Beethoven remix. Alan, it's a really fun project, this Beethoven remix project. Thank you for sharing it with us on Soundcheck
today.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing how it all turns out.
Me too. It's Alan Pearson and the Brooklyn Philharmonic, June 9th in Bed-Stuy. Here are the Swagbrarians. We'll be right back. Still to come, the Norwegian singer-songwriter Sondre Lerche has lived in New York for a number of years. His latest album, though, is the first one he's written entirely here in the city. We'll hear songs from it live in our studio next on Soundcheck.
That we were could kill the ghost. Maybe I'd cooperate, but I'm done. That's not.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Earlier, we heard about professional song plugging, a world fueled by people who write songs not for themselves but for others, like Lieber and Stoller, for example. Well, Sondre Lerche is a different kind of professional songwriter. He writes songs for himself. In fact, the Norwegian singer-songwriter's latest record is also called Sondre Lerche. And in a moment, we'll hear more about that album and what's on the horizon for the Brooklyn transplant. But first, a live performance. Sondre Lerche doing Coliseum Town on Soundcheck.
Coliseum Town, not a living soul around. I go stumbling cobble streets with a map you drew on me, and I can't decide, did you leave or even arrive? I've been known to make things up. Now I'm talking to my cup. What's the chance of you returning? Coliseum Town. Should I wait around? Maybe I'm mistaken. This dream's taken. Who put these thoughts in my head? I'd better put it to bed when I wake from dream inside a dream. To divert my mind, I try to make another love song rhyme, but it's harder than it seems to describe what I just dreamed. Coliseum Town, tell me if I'm out of line. I may just have had too much, or just never quite enough. Now the cobblestones are swinging. Am I singing? Coliseum Town, should I wait around? Maybe I'm mistaken. This dream's taken. The bartender showed me the door. I fell asleep on your floor in another dream inside a dream. Dream inside a dream.
That is Sondre Lerche, live on Soundcheck with a song called Coliseum Town, which appears on his latest release, self-titled. Sondre Lerche, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, sir.
So we were talking before about, you know, song plugging. You know, Lieber and Stoller would write songs for Elvis Presley and the Drifters and all these other people and stuff. Have you ever written songs for other people?
I don't think I've ever sat down and thought I'm going to write for someone other than myself. But I write a lot of songs, and I do have songs that sort of get lost in the shuffle, or for one reason or another, they just don't fit whatever I'm looking at, looking for at the moment. So I do have songs that I've let other people record, and I'd be happy to have that happen more in the future, because I have so many songs lying around that I'm probably never going to record myself.
So sometimes you will write a song and you'll look at it and say, "Yeah, that's not for me."
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. And other people have come along and said, "Well, I'll take that. I'll sing."
Yeah, people. Yeah, right. You know, people ask, you know, do you do that? Do you have something? And you know, I'll send something over, and sometimes they, you know, they bite. They get into it.
So you're not only a songwriter, you are your own song plugger as well.
Yeah,
it's not quite the old days of sitting in the store window at the piano playing popular songs of the day. But
I haven't, you know, followed any performers around the country trying to get them to perform my songs. But maybe, you know,
now if there were a performer out there that you would follow around for 8,000 miles just to play one of your songs to him or her, who would it be?
Oh, well, that's tricky, you know, because it's a bit different now, with at least with, like, sort of the classic sort of songwriting format now. Most people want to write their own songs, yeah. You know, and there's a certain credibility, it seems, that people are interested in that comes with having at least been a part of writing, you know, writing your own material. And the artists who don't write their own material are in a very different genre than what I probably can't do much for the, you know, that kind of artist. But, you know, someone like, and I know she also writes a lot of her own stuff, but Norah Jones would be fun to write a song for. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, obviously now I'm sure every professional songwriter is trying to write the next Adele hit song,
right?
You know, and because she has that sort of more, it's grounded in more classical pop songwriting,
R&B,
yeah. And it has a bit of that Brill Building vibe to it, and you know, I'm sure that could be cool, but you know, I get so caught up when I sit down, I always get caught up in trying to write something that I really want to record. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm on to the next project.
Well, now the next song you're going to play for us is actually, this has got to be 7 or 8 years old now, right?
Yeah.
So is it unusual for you to, you know, because you are writing so many songs, to kind of go that far back in your catalog?
Well, you know, when I play regular shows, I go back to certain songs and I still enjoy playing quite a few of them, and now recently I've been going back through my catalog, because we're reissuing a lot of my older records on vinyl and with a lot of bonus material, so I've had to go back and reassess some of it and some of it, you know, I feel proud of when I hear it again, and then some I'm happy to leave behind and never you know, never look back. But there is there's a couple that I still enjoy playing, and there's a couple that I enjoy finding new ways to play. And today I'm a bit my throat's a bit sore, and then I find certain songs are better for that, the kind of limited range that you have when you wake up in the morning and you're
well, when the temperature drops 30 degrees in 24 hours, as
exactly.
It has done here in New
this
York, that's going to happen to people.
Yeah.
So you're going to do Two-Way Monologue.
Yeah, that's the one.
A 2004 song. It's Sandra Lerca. He's performing live for us on Soundcheck.
Mom, all the other options that you had in mind, starve me, 'cause I'm optionless and techie free and blind. But won't you listen and I let you in on this? Blind me, won't you listen? I'll reduce advice to dust. Oh no, I shouldn't have to spell my name. Mom,
if it's worth the made-up smiles, the quiet fights. Oh, mother, it is hard not to look in the mirror's eyes. I have come to this while you have come and gone. So it's all right if you change your mind the other way around again. I shouldn't have to spell my name to stop the two-way monologue that speaks your mind. We're talking two-way monologue with words that rhyme. We can't reclaim the shirts we threw away last twirl. Uncurl the note in pocket, personal overshirts, that dust machine wash, that's how paper is. Days you spend wanting some of Michael Landon's grace. Strike back. Now they shape your life as stony as his face. Oh no, I shouldn't have to spell his name. So stop the two-way monologue that speaks your mind. We're talking two-way monologue with words that rhyme. Stop the two-way monologue that speaks your mind. We're talking two-way monologue. We were chasing rabbits on the hill. Oh, that prairie life was great, but never real. 'Cause we never saw no rabbits out there, ever, no, not once. All we did was put a fire up, watch it burn for months. And I miss the sound of stairs and walls and mouth adjusted doors, and too little space for holding all the soldiers and the war. Stop the two-way monologue with speech of mine. We're talking two-way monologue with words that rhyme. Stop the two-way monologue with speech of mine. We're talking two-way monologue.
That is Sandra Lerca live on Soundtrack. So that's what you pull out when you have a sore throat.
Yeah. you gotta change the key. So I took this one down
a
couple of steps, and then you compensate for the lack of voice by doing all sorts of stupid stuff on the guitar. You know?
Two-Way Monologue is the name of Sandra Lerca's song. He is playing tomorrow night here in New York at City Winery as part of John Wesley Harding's variety show, John Wesley Harding's Cabinet of Wonders. And we're also, as we did last time you were here, Sandra, videotaping the performances. It'll be on our website. The last time you were here, one of those videos has gathered over 180,000 views on our on our YouTube page. So I assume some of those folks are probably back home in Norway watching. But you've been here now in New York for a number of years. Kevi from Brooklyn leaves this on our webpage. I think of him as a Brooklyn singer-songwriter.
Well, I appreciate that.
Do you now consider yourself a Brooklyn singer-songwriter?
Yeah, I think that sounds pretty good, you know? Mm-hmm. It depends who you're talking with. So I find I try to use whatever I feel sounds better in whatever company I'm in. But I'm proud to be considered a Brooklyn artist because there's a lot of good stuff coming out of Brooklyn.
There is.
So, yeah.
Including your latest record, the self-titled and self-released,
yes.
Sondra Lerca. I want to give you a chance to actually play something more recent for us. You want to do Living Dangerously?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. It's Sondra Lerca live on Soundcheck.
5 years have passed since our old friends all exclaimed, why rush to waste it away? Don't hang your ambition and sense out to dry. But I still know, just as I knew well back then, we had nothing to defend. Now all our friends are out mowing the lawn. I'm not trying to disrespect, but I don't want to build a house. This old place will do for now, to settle for and settle down. Never really crossed my mind. Oh, I'll be living dangerously with you instead. I might have said, but you're letting things slide, passively biding your time for something better to arrive, only to settle for what you're assigned. But I won't quit any uncomfortable cues, only congrats and good for yous. Now that our friends are in debt and expecting, and not trying to disrespect, but selfish as I know it sounds, I would hate to compromise. Settle for the solid ground wasn't even on my mind. Oh, I'll be living dangerously with you instead. Oh, I'll be living dangerously with you.
Once again, Sondra Lerca, live on Soundcheck with Living Dangerously. I meant to say this after the last song, Two-Way Monologue, but I'll say it after this one, too, because it holds true, which is, if you didn't attack the guitar strings so loud, so hard, I think it might be obvious that some of those harmonies are, like, right out of bossa nova.
I like the sort of juxtaposition between, you know, if you have... Yeah, the kind of harmonies and chords that I enjoy. A lot of that comes from jazz, bossa nova, you know, all over the place. But playing it, you know, as a, you know, three chord punk song or a folk song, you know, with the sort of obvious natural feel. So I go pretty hard and dynamic with that stuff. Yeah.
The album is called Sondra Lerca, came out last year. It is Sondra's most recent, and he's performing tomorrow at City Winery here in Lower Manhattan, part of John Wesley Harding's Cabinet of Wonders. Sondra, great pleasure to have you back with us.
My pleasure.
Today. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On Monday, the first installment of a two-part series about music and animals. We'll hear how creatures in the wild use the sounds of their habitats to survive. Plus another wild animal, former hardcore punk Frank Turner, joins us to play live. And also, we'll have a preview of next week's South by Southwest Music Festival. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Amy Pearl, Jenna Gildasis, and Crystal Kim. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.